Thanks a lot, Michael, and thanks to all of you for coming, especially so late in the academic year and in such beautiful weather. I'm going to talk about the rise and fall of liberal foreign policies during the 1990s today. And it's clear that some of you will vividly remember that period, but some of you, the lucky ones, actually will not, because they're much too young to have experienced it. So I'm going to start by taking you back to the 1990s and to basically explain a little bit what actually happened at the time. The story of the rise of liberal foreign policies starts right there with the end of the Cold War. The end of the Cold War was, of course, interpreted as a victory of liberalism over communism. But its significance was wider, because at the end of the Cold War, liberalism was left with a kind of monopoly in the world. It seemed to be the only political ideology with any sort of universal appeal out there, and there were absolutely no serious economic, political, or military competitors on the horizon. And it was this fact that got people to interpret the end of the Cold War as of much wider significance for liberalism. It got people to think that history had basically validated liberalism, had validated, had proven right liberal assumptions, principles, practices, and institutions. And it was this assumption that led people like Francis Fukuyama famously to argue that we had reached the end of history. But Fukuyama was, of course, not the only one who actually made such kinds of assumptions. There were a lot of people out there at the time who were thinking that there was some particular alignment or match or fit between liberalism and its assumptions and principles and practices and the forces of history. And it was this assumption that basically gave rise to a tremendous boost of optimism. And that optimism, in the end, led to the rise and also then to the fall of liberal foreign policies. Because, after all, if liberal principles and practices were singularly aligned with the forces of history, and if all external barriers, like the Soviet Union, to the spread of liberal principles were out of the way, then the path was clear, of course, to spread and realize liberal principles worldwide. And this, in turn, the assumption was, would bring freedom, prosperity, human rights, cooperation, and peace to all people and peoples. Now, that sounds rather hubristic from today's perspective, but it's quite important to remember that at the time, broadly speaking, these were quite realistic assumptions for a lot of people. And it was these assumptions that underpinned the rise of liberal foreign policies that characterized the 1990s. These policies aimed broadly to spread liberal principles in three main areas. The first was they aimed to spread liberal political institutions, basically democracy promotion. Secondly, they aimed to spread liberal economic practices and institutions, and this became known as neoliberal economic policies. And finally, they aim to spread liberal norms, largely in the form of human rights. And the particular policies that were most famously aligned with this aim was humanitarian intervention. So let me tell you a little bit about the fate of these policies in turn. Starting with democracy promotion. The assumption behind policies of democracy promotion were that one should introduce elections in countries that hadn't had any, that these elections would in themselves then kind of kickstart a process of political liberalization. And this political liberalization, in turn, would contribute to domestic and international peace. There were quite a lot of different actors involved in these policies, liberal states, of course, but also NGOs and international organizations. And the policies themselves could take rather different forms. There was technical and financial aid to set up the first free and fair elections in the country. In the context of the Third World, development aid was made conditional on moves towards democratization. Democracy promotion policies also played an important role in the peace building operations, peacekeeping operations of the United Nations, where the idea was that the introduction of democracy would basically provide a nonviolent form of conflict resolution for these societies. And finally, of course, there were a few cases in which military interventions were undertaken in order to replace an authoritarian with a democratic regime. At the beginning of the 1990s, these policies actually seemed to be quite successful. Huge numbers of countries actually started to have elections for the first time or have them again after a period of authoritarianism. And there was a lot of talk about the third wave of democratization. But it then soon turned out that these elections were actually not having the expected results, the results of political liberalization and pacification. Although some countries, of course, consolidated democracies and some other countries reverted back to authoritarianism, the vast majority of all those countries that introduced elections at the beginning of the 1990s ended up as what was then called illiberal democracies. These are basically states in which democratic elections serve to legitimate the one or other form of authoritarian regime. And the prime example for this, of course, or the most well-known example of this is Russia. It also turned out that elections did not necessarily help to pacify internal conflicts. In many cases where elections were introduced, they made no difference to civil conflict at all. And in some cases, they even exacerbated these conflicts. So for example, in Angola, the introduction of elections led to renewed fighting, and in that fighting, more people died than in the previous 18 years of civil war. And we only have to look at Afghanistan and Iraq to see that military interventions to replace authoritarian with democratic regimes, of course, did not necessarily lead to consolidated democracies within those states or to domestic or international pacification. So what about the liberal economic policies? The assumption behind these policies was that private property, free markets, and free trade would engender economic growth. And this general economic growth would translate into an increase in prosperity and also, of course, into interdependence through trade between countries, which in turn would lay the foundations for cooperation and peace. And again, we have a lot of different actors involved in these policies, liberal states, international organizations, but also companies. These neoliberal economic policies, again, took quite different forms in different kinds of contexts. So, for example, in Eastern Europe, where market economy had to be established from scratch, privatization played a very important role. But we also know that privatization played some role in the first and third worlds. For example, when public transport, health, education, and such services were being privatized. These policies also included the deregulation and liberalization of trade and markets, and partly they were pursued through the establishment of international organizations like the World Trade Organization, and in some cases, especially in the third world again, also through conditional lending. So, and just like the democracy promotion policies at the beginning, these policies seem to be quite successful because there was quite a big increase in the volume of trade in the early 1990s. But then it turned out that the expected overall growth remained elusive. As you can see there, it's actually gone down. So because of this, then there was, of course, then also no general increase in prosperity. But instead, we found that there was an increasing gap between rich and poor countries, as well as individuals within countries. Privatization policies, especially famously in the case of intellectual property rights, had negative consequences in some cases. So poor countries were suddenly unable to afford AIDS medication. And some of you, my colleagues, may remember that as a result of these policies, the copyright laws changed. And we were standing here from one day to the next being unable to provide the students with readers for their courses. It was quite a scramble at the time. And of course, on top of that, these neoliberal economic policies also led to a range of economic and financial crises already during the 1990s. And we're all, I think, painfully aware that they have gone global now. So what was the situation with normative policies or human rights? Here the assumption was that a reform of international law and international organization was now possible with the Soviet Union out of the way, that international law and international organization could be better aligned with or express better liberal principles. And this would then in turn provide the foundation for protection basically of human rights in general and worldwide. Part of the policies that that were undertaken or called for at the time were calls for legalization of humanitarian intervention. There were ideas that international organizations should be reformed, for example, the UN Security Council, but in such a way that a club of democratic states would be established above the Security Council, which could then authorize interventions in cases where the Council itself was deadlocked. There were moves towards the development of international criminal law, and of course, in practice, also the attempt to protect human rights more widely through humanitarian interventions. And at first, when we just look at the increase of activities by the United Nations with its peacekeeping operations, this again looked quite promising. But my page is stuck. Yeah. But it soon became clear that the goals of these policies were much harder to achieve than anticipated. In Bosnia, for example, intervention forces were standing by while massacres were occurring. In Somalia, intervention forces became embroiled in the military conflict itself and suffered casualties as a result and were then quickly withdrawn. In Rwanda, which is this picture, almost 1 million people died without an intervention occurring. And in Kosovo, an intervention occurred, and when it was all over, people were asking, well, where are the bodies? Similarly mixed outcomes attended the reform policies that were undertaken. So, for example, the responsibility to protect was eventually adopted by the UN General Assembly, but General Assembly resolutions actually have no standing under international law. So this does not amount to a legalization of humanitarian intervention, and it does not actually entail a legal obligation to intervene in cases of humanitarian disasters. In some cases, particularly with regard to the reform of international organizations, hardly any progress was made at all. And in other cases where there was progress, for example, with the establishment of the International Criminal Court, it turned out that this institution then had to operate without the support of the most important liberal state in the world, the United States. So overall, the liberal foreign policies of the early 1990s had very mixed and, to some extent, contradictory outcomes. It turned out that democracy was perfectly capable of serving authoritarian rule, that liberal economic policies produced wealth as well as poverty, that the human rights of some people were protected and those of others were not. And that these policies did not actually achieve their stated goals became clear very quickly. already by the mid-1990s, major actors in the field were actually changing, reforming their policies in recognition of this fact. So democracy promotion, for example, was suddenly seen as a longer-term commitment that actually required the overhaul of the entirety of the civil society of target states. The UN moved from peacekeeping to peace-building operations, which basically meant that it recognized the need for post-conflict reconstruction. And the World Bank decided that its structural adjustment policies hadn't worked because the people in target countries were still too attached to their traditional cultures and institutions, and it moved therefore to the good governance policies. By the end of the 1990s, the optimism of the beginning of the decade was all but gone. There was no one anymore out there who was promising the realization of liberal principles worldwide in either the near or even the medium term. In fact, on the contrary, people were talking again about power politics being the name of the game. So the question that I want to pursue in the remainder of this lecture is, why did these policies fail? And especially, why did they fail given that the auspicious circumstances of the beginning of the decade, the monopoly of liberalism, had actually not changed? And I'm going to do this in two steps. I'm going to first tell you a little bit what the conventional explanation of these failures are, and then I'm going to develop an alternative. The liberal foreign policies of the 1990s were very, very closely observed right from the start, and there is a vast literature out there that lists a wide range of empirical problems with these policies. But when we boil these problems down, we can come up with actually three major categories of problems. The first was that it turned out that liberal economic, liberal political, and liberal normative or human rights policies could, under certain circumstances, contradict each other, stood in tension with each other, undermined each other. So, for example, liberal economic policies are, of course, interested in marketization. Marketization means that you have to reduce tariffs, subsidies, all those kinds of things that stand in the way of the free market. Now, in a lot of poor countries, of course, you have subsidies, for example, of basic foodstuffs like bread. If you would take these subsidies away, the bread gets more expensive. And this, of course, is not at all in the interest of the majority of the population. In this kind of situation, you have two choices. Either you go with democracy, listen to the interests of the majority of the population, in which case you do not get marketization. Or you push through marketization, but you can only do that against the desire of the majority of the population and with the help of the one or other form of authoritarian government. So we have a tension between the goal of democracy promotion and the goal of neoliberal economic policies. And such tensions actually happen in all these areas quite a lot. The second problem area was that it turned out that there were contradictions between liberal domestic and liberal international policies. Internationally, for example, liberal actors generally pushed for market principles, but domestically, they continued to protect domestic industry or, as we all know famously, agriculture. The same happened with regard to human rights. It was argued explicitly that the protection of the freedom and human rights of American citizens, for example, required the violation of the human rights of foreigners in Guantanamo Bay or Bagram or through extraordinary rendition. These tensions between the domestic and international policies of liberal actors, of course, undermined the possibility of realizing these liberal principles, because the target states could, of course, say, well, you protect your agriculture, why shouldn't we? You torture your prisoners, why shouldn't we? The third problem that the literature turned up was that there was a contradiction between, oftentimes, between liberal principles and practices, or means and ends. In theory, democracy is, of course, supposed to embody and protect the right to freedom and self-determination. In practice, democracy promotion policies, of course, reflect the political interests of outsiders, not those of the selves. And this is, of course, particularly the case when they're undertaken by military means. So in sum, three problems were identified. Contradictions between liberal economic, liberal political, and liberal normative policies, tensions between domestic and international liberal policies, and tensions between the means and ends of liberal policies. Now, where did these tensions and contradictions come from? According to the conventional explanation, the reason for these tensions is that the actors, in practice, did not yet live up to liberal principles in theory. So liberal actors would endorse a liberal principle like human rights, for example, in theory, but when it came to sacrificing their soldiers for the sake of other people's human rights, they were not ready to make that sacrifice. They would endorse, in principle, the idea of free trade, but when that demanded that short-term material interests had to be sacrificed, they weren't ready to make that sacrifice. A similar argument actually was also applied to non-liberal actors. Non-liberal actors appear to be much too attached to traditional illiberal cultures and institutions. So the basic explanation, the conventional explanation, was that practice didn't yet live up to theory. And the reason why this gap had kind of occurred was because in the heady days of the end of the Cold War, people had gotten carried away and had interpreted the approximation of practice to liberal theory in a much too optimistic way. So theory was fine, liberal theory was fine, but practice was insufficient. Now, I think that this explanation does not quite fit the facts. And this is because the tensions and contradictions that attend liberal foreign policies are equally found in contemporary liberal theories. There are theories that associate liberalism with political institutions and have absolutely nothing much to say about economics. There are liberal economic theories that will never, ever utter the word human rights. There are liberal human rights theories that are not at all interested in the practices and institutions on the ground. There are theories that define liberalism in terms of its norms, and there are others that define it in terms of its empirical practices. There's a clear distinction between liberal theory in political theory pertaining to the domestic sphere and liberal international theories. So all the contradictions that we find in liberal foreign policies during the period are also to be found in liberal theories. So I would conclude from this that the failures of these liberal foreign policies cannot actually be blamed on practice alone. That if we want to find out where these tensions and contradictions come from, then we need to investigate also the origins of these contradictions in liberal theory itself. And in order to do this, I'm now going to take you back to the origins of liberalism, and in particular to this man, John Locke, who was one of the first to draw out core principles of liberalism and to theorize them in a systematic kind of way. Locke argued at the core of his theory that there were three main principles that underpinned or ought to underpin human society. These were private property, individual freedom, and government by consent. And he arranged these principles in a very neat theoretical construction, actually a constitutive relationship. He argued that private property constitutes individual freedom, that individual freedom constitutes government by consent, and that government protects private property. So we have a really nice little circle there. Now, the thing was that Locke was actually not content with having produced a nice little, neat little theoretical construction. He actually developed this theory as a solution to the political, religious, and intellectual crisis of the 17th century. In other words, he was interested in realizing these principles. He wanted society to be organized on the basis of these principles. And this is where he ran into real problems. And he ran into problems because his theory did not actually reflect what was happening on the ground. At the time when Locke was writing, most people did not have any private property at all. Because of this, of course, according to his own theory, they were not free individuals in the liberal sense. And without these free individuals, you couldn't have government by consent. And without that government by consent, there couldn't be protection, systematic protection of private property. So there was a huge gap between theory and practice in Locke's work. And it confronted Locke with the problem of bridging this gap. And in order to do this, he made two really crucial additions to his theory. The first was that he introduced a philosophy of history. This philosophy of history was basically designed to explain the disjuncture between theory and practice. And in a nutshell, it went something like this. In the state of nature, society was actually organized in accordance with his principles of private property, individual freedom, and government by consent. And the evidence was clear to see for everyone who wanted to see it. Indigenous societies in America, he argued, were still organized precisely on the basis of these principles. But then what happened was that money was invented. And this led to more intensive production, which led to enclosure of land, and therefore also to competition over land, which turned into wars. And it was in the context of these wars that military leaders came to the fore who established despotic governments and justified these despotic governments with reference to tradition and convention. And it was living under these governments that people eventually forgot their natural rights of private property, individual freedom, and government by consent. So this philosophy of history explains why there is a lack in the presence between, a lack of correspondence in the presence between Locke's theory and the practice on the ground. But of course, Locke went further and said, now that we have rediscovered these proper principles of social organization, we can realize them in the future. So what he did was he introduced the philosophy of history to bridge the gap between theory and practice. That is, basically, he inserted time into this gap. But in order for time to play this role of bridging the gap, time itself had to be divided. And it had to be divided in reference to the realization or not, or the approximation or not to liberal principles. So from now on, in Locke's theory, all societies are measured by their level of development with regard to the approximation of liberal principles. Now, of course, this still doesn't tell us how we get from the theory to the realization of these liberal principles in practice. And this leads us to the second addition that Locke made. The problem, remember, was that he didn't have any free people, and therefore he couldn't have liberal government, and so on and so forth. But in accordance with his own core theory, you could produce free people, free individuals in the liberal sense. And you did that quite simply by giving them private property. And so what Locke argued was the solution to the problem was the privatization of common property, all that green land there. This could then be used to give individuals private property, and that would set them up as liberal individuals. Now, the problem with this solution, well, there are actually two problems that come along with this solution. The first was that the privatization of common property, of course, simultaneously deprives all the people who rely on this green land for their livelihoods of their livelihoods. These people have no interest in such policies, and they would not consent to these policies. Locke's solution to this problem was to give political rights to property owners only and to deny these rights to non-property owners. This, of course, still left a society in which was wrecked by quite a lot of tensions between the rich and the poor and between the politically emancipated and those that were oppressed. The second problem that Locke encountered with his solution of the privatization of common property was that there simply wasn't enough common property out there in England to furnish all the poor people, at least in principle, with private property. And so Locke looked abroad and he said, look at all this common land in America. It's so huge, it actually suffices in principle to provide all the people with common property. And so he advocated colonialism. So in sum, the realization of liberal principles, according to Locke, required policies of privatization, expropriation, and policies of political emancipation and oppression. What Locke did was, in order to bridge that gap between theory and practice, was to insert space into it. But just like time before, in order to play that bridging role, space itself had to be divided. So common land had to be turned into private parcels, foreign lands had to be colonized, political space had to be divided between free and non-free individuals, and between a domestic and an international sphere. Now, Locke's conception of liberalism, as I've boiled it down quite crudely here, is different in at least four respects, I think, from contemporary liberal theories. The first is it entails all the core elements of liberalism, the core dimensions of liberalism: individual freedom, private property, government by consent, and a meliorist conception of history. Or in other terms, it contains the political, normative, economic, and historical dimension of liberalism. Secondly, Locke explicitly states a constitutive relationship between these different dimensions of liberalism. He makes it clear that there can be no individual freedom without private property, there can be no government by consent without individual freedom, and there can be no private property without government protection. Thirdly, Locke identifies the policies explicitly that are necessary to realize liberal principles in practice. And these policies are privatization and expropriation and political emancipation and political oppression. Now, having identified these policies, Locke's theory also, of course, contains quite a clear statement of the consequences of these policies, the historical dynamics of liberalism. Because privatization and expropriation, or political emancipation and political oppression, of course, produce liberal as well as non-liberal actors, interests, and institutions. They produce tensions within society. And these tensions require management. And that management, in Locke's theory, I think, takes the form of the fragmentation of space and time. It's reflected in the distinctions that we're making today between the domestic and the international space, between developed and developing countries, time, and between liberal and non-liberal actors. Now, let me return to the 1990s, to our liberal foreign policies of the 1990s. And when we put these liberal foreign policies of the 1990s next to the Lockean conception of liberalism, we can see that they perfectly match. First of all, when liberal foreign policies during the 1990s pursued privatization, they adopted the very core policy that Locke had identified as necessary for the realization of liberal principles. And when these policies were not in everyone's interest, then the tensions were dealt with by inserting time between the economic and the political dimension of liberalism. First privatization, then democratization. Just as Locke had done when he said, well, first we give the political rights to property owners only. In fact, it matches the entire history of liberalism, which has a long period of privatization and very late democratization. Secondly, when liberal actors defended benefits and subsidies at home, like these people here do, and demanded that the cuts actually were made somewhere else, they relieved the tensions that liberalism created within the domestic sphere by exploiting power differentials in the international sphere, just as Locke had done when he advocated colonialism as a solution to these tensions, to these internal tensions. Thirdly, when liberal actors in the 1990s tried to establish freedom by force or protect human rights through wars or produce prosperity through expropriation, they were perfectly in line with Locke, for whom privatization was based on expropriation, required expropriation, for whom political emancipation required political oppression. So this fundamental fit between the Lockean conception of liberal principles and the liberal foreign policies of the 1990s suggests that it was actually not liberal practice that failed to live up to liberal theory, but rather that contemporary liberal theories had failed to grasp the dynamics of liberal practice. So what does all this tell us then about the rise and fall of liberal foreign policies? Well, first of all, the rise of liberal foreign policies was indeed, as was assumed at the time, due to a shift in power relations. It was the demise of the Soviet Union that opened up the possibility to pursue liberal principles in previously inaccessible areas. But it was the very same power that precipitated the fall of liberal foreign policies, because that power led to optimism and activism. And the more proactive liberal foreign policies were, the quicker they reproduced the core historical dynamics of liberalism: internal tensions, fragmentations, and resistance. And I want to conclude by mentioning three areas in which I think this analysis has some wider implications. The first concerns the relationship between liberalism and history. It suggests that it is actually not history that validates liberalism, as observers at the end of the Cold War thought, but rather liberalism, with its internal contradictions and fragmentary dynamics, that shapes history. Secondly, and this concerns the relationship between liberalism and power, it suggests that the moments of liberalism's greatest triumph simultaneously generate its most serious crises. And thirdly, with regard to liberal foreign policies, it suggests that the greatest challenge for liberal foreign policies does not consist in confronting external competitors like the Soviet Union, but in trying to avoid producing such competitors. Thank you.